We haven't had a Thursday evening satsang in a long time. I thought we would take advantage of the opportunity. And not just because it's Thursday, but because we're near the end of the world, there is an urgency in intensively focusing on self-realization while there is still sufficient peace to be able to have the luxury of doing that. And it must be understood, and I'm sure it probably is by many by this time, that we are in a time of sudden changes and sudden death is happening, mass death all over the world for many different reasons. The karma of every soul is hitting the fan. And so, because we never know when our number is called, it is urgent to be in that state of jivan mukti as soon as possible, so that consciousness is free of karma and free of any attachments that would bring one back into the womb of another mother just before the end. It's wise to not have to return into the human world as it's ending, but to abide in the light, in that state of victorious transcendence over the illusion. But to achieve that, there must be a very powerful practice that can withstand the shocks that may occur to the body and to the mind during that process of the body's dying and any of the attendant circumstances that surround such an event, and whatever happens in the environment that can cause shock and grief if one witnesses the death of others to whom one had attachments. And so it is of extreme importance to realize the one self, the deathless and birthless self, in order to be free of any such reactivity, and not to be brought down into a lower state of consciousness as a result of such karmic events. So, for that reason, as I said last night, we would return to the basics of the teachings of Sri Ramana, and I thought I picked out a few at semi-randomly, but not entirely, quotes from Talks, which is a book that was written by kind of a secretary at the ashram of Ramana during the period of the mid-30s. And probably many of you have read the book already. But I thought for those who haven't especially, but even if you have, it's always good to return to these fundamental aspects of reality that Ramana expresses so clearly and concisely. So I'll start with this one. It's a conversation he's having with Mr. Evans Wentz, who's a famous writer on Tibetan Buddhism, who asks, is work an obstruction to self-realization? By the way, this happens January 24th, 1935, if anyone wants to look it up. I think the pages are different in the most recent editions. Is work an obstruction to self-realization? And Ramana says, no. For a realized being, the self alone is the reality, and actions are only phenomenal, not affecting the self. Even when he acts, he has no sense of being an agent. This is extremely important. His actions are only involuntary, meaning spontaneous, without intention, and he remains a witness to them without any attachment. Okay, this is the meaning of karma yoga. No attachment, no sense of doership, and no intention. So he goes on, there is no aim for such action. Even one who is still practicing the path of jnana can practice while engaged in work. It may be difficult in the earlier stages for a beginner, but after some practice, it will soon be effective, and the work will not be found a hindrance to meditation. This is extremely important now because our workload will actually increase as we reach the period of the end and have to plug holes in Noah's Ark to keep it seaworthy. And we will have to be in a state of meditation while the body is functioning. And only if we have practiced this to such an extent that it's second nature, in fact, first nature, having that we have returned to, will we not be disturbed by the bodily activity. But this, without having achieved this capacity, then the ability to go into a deep state while we're sitting in meditation will not be of any use when we're on the battlefield. And so this practice is essential. Okay, and then I'm going to skip to a conversation in the middle of a long conversation. Let's see, where does this one begin? This is on 4th February, 1935. And this is Ramana speaking, as propounded by all, in other words, all the sages of all the traditions, and realized by all true seekers, fixity in the Supreme Spirit, Brahmanishta is the word that he used, meaning Brahman, right? Fixity, in other words, being absolutely fixed in that state without any movement away from it. In fixity in the Supreme Spirit alone can make us know and realize the Spirit. So if we move in and out of it, you do not have realization of it. You can have glimpses of it, but that will not bring liberation. It being of us and in us, any amount of discrimination, vivechana, can lead us only one step forward by making us renouncers, by goading us to discard the seeming world as transitory and to hold fast to the eternal truth and presence alone. So, our understanding of it intellectually is useful only up to a point, and then that must be dropped as well, because that will get in the way. because any intellectual comprehension brings you into a state of duality, because then it is as if you are not Brahman and you're looking at Brahman, but Brahman is everything. And so it's a delusion to think you can ever be aware of Brahman as an object. So it's only by letting go of the mind in the sense of symbolic thought that one can realize the self. The conversation turned upon the question as to whether Ishvara Prasad, divine grace, is necessary for the attaining of Samrajya, that means the kingdom of God, really, or whether a jiva's honest and strenuous efforts to attain it cannot of themselves lead him to that from whence there is no return to life and death. And Ramana says with an ineffable smile which lit up his face, which was all-pervasive, shining upon the coterie around him, he replied in tones of certainty and with the ring of truth, divine grace is essential for realization. It leads one to God realization. But such grace is vouchsafed only to him who is a true devotee or a yogi, in other words, a bhakta or a jnani, who has striven hard and ceaselessly on the path toward freedom. So in other words, we have to earn our grace. It doesn't come gratuitously. It comes as a result of our effort. Our effort doesn't cause it, but God's mercy on one who has shown that level of strenuous effort and sincerity and yearning, the grace will be granted. But it has to come as grace, because if it came as a result of the ego, you wouldn't let go of the ego. It would just make the ego more megalomaniacal, thinking I have achieved God, you know, or whatever. So it is that final surrender of the sense of doership that is the grace that brings liberation. Okay, that's enough from that conversation. Okay, this one on 6th July, 1935. A question is asked, how is dhyana means meditation, how is it practiced? With eyes open or closed? You know, in the ashram I was in India, they didn't allow you to close your eyes when you meditate. You had to keep them open. Here we keep them closed because I think people in the West are more scattered and more open to distraction. But it's very important to be able to meditate equally with eyes open as well as closed, and to be able to function without limitation. But in any case, Ramana answers like this. It may be done either way. The point is that the mind must be introverted and kept active in its pursuit. In other words, the pursuit of the realization of the source of the I am-ness or of attention itself. So activity, the mind doesn't become passive. If the mind ever becomes passive, you'll fall asleep or you'll get distracted. So sometimes it happens that when the eyes are closed, the latent thoughts rush forth with great vigor. In other words, with your eyes closed, the danger is you're going to start having fantasies and memories and reveries and get lost in that. So if that's happening, open your eyes and stare at a candle or just return to Atma-vichara. It may also be difficult, however, to introvert the mind with eyes open. It requires strength of mind to do so, because the mind is contaminated when it takes in an object. It becomes identified with it, and it becomes interested in the object rather than in its own awareness. Otherwise, the consciousness remains pure. The main factor in dhyana is to keep the mind active, but in its own pursuit of the self without taking in any external impressions or thinking of anything else. Okay, so I think that's a very good definition and explanation of dhyana. It goes on and deals with spurana and other topics, but I think for tonight we'll leave it at that. And now let's go into the topic of death, since that's how we started this evening. News of someone's death was brought to Sri Bhagavan, and he said, "Good. The dead are indeed happy. They have got rid of the troublesome overgrowth of the body. The dead man doesn't grieve. The survivors might grieve for the man who's dead, but do men fear sleep? On the contrary, sleep is courted, and sometimes people don't want to wake up and lose their sleep, right? So on waking up, every man, if he had a deep sleep, says he slept happily. One prepares the bed for sound sleep. Sleep is a temporary death, but death is just a longer sleep. If the man dies while yet alive, he doesn't grieve over others' death. One's existence is evident with or without the body, as in waking, dream, and sleep. Then, why should one desire continuance of the bodily shackles? Let the man find out his undying self and die and be immortal while alive and be happy." So I hope you take that seriously, because the fear of death often ends up to be the main obstacle to liberation. And only when you realize you are deathless will you be free. Here's another one about that topic. This is 3rd October 1935. A very devoted and simple disciple had lost his only son, a child of 3 years. The next day he arrived at the ashram with his family. The master spoke with reference to them. "Training of mind helps one to bear sorrows and bereavements with courage. But the loss of one's offspring is said to be the worst of all griefs. Grief exists only so long as one considers oneself to be of a definite form. If the form is transcended, one will know that the one self is eternal. There is no death and no birth. That which is born is only the body. The body is the creation of the ego." Very important point. We tend to think that the body is formed first and then the ego is acquired in relation to the environment, the mother's fantasies, etc., because that's the level of the ego that becomes an operating system. But if there hadn't been egoic sanskaras left over from a previous life, one would not have been born to a particular mother. You know, there's a karmic connection from a past life that causes one's desire and karma to be born in a body and in a particular body with a particular condition, gender, particular family system and karma that emerges. But all of that comes from the underlying ego sanskaras that produce the body itself. But the ego is not ordinarily perceived without the body. It is always identified with the body. It is the thought which matters. Let the sensible man consider if he knew his body in deep sleep. Why does he feel it in the waking state? But although the body was not felt in sleep, did not the self exist then? How was he in deep sleep? How is he when awake? What is the difference? Ego rises up, and that is what is called waking. Simultaneously, thoughts arise, but let him find out to whom are the thoughts. Where from do they arise? They must spring up from the conscious self. Apprehending it even vaguely helps the extinction of the ego. Thereafter, the realization of the one infinite existence becomes possible. In that state, there are no individuals, only the one eternal existence. Hence, there is no thought of death or wailing. If a man considers he is born, he cannot avoid the fear of death. Let him find out if he has been born, or if the self has any birth at all. He will discover that the self always is, that the body which is born resolves itself into thought, and that the emergence of thought is the root of all mischief. Find where from thoughts emerge. And then you will abide in the ever-present inmost self and be free from the idea of birth and the fear of death. A disciple asked how to do it. And Ramana says, the thoughts are only vasanas. These are the predispositions to have thoughts. Vasanas accumulated in innumerable births before. Their annihilation is the aim of yoga, right? The annihilation of the predisposition to have egoic thoughts. The state free from vasanas is the primal state and the eternal state of purity. And then the questioner says, I'm not clear on it yet. Ramana says, everyone is aware of the eternal self. He sees so many dying, but he still thinks himself eternal because it is the truth. Unwillingly, the natural truth asserts itself. The man is deluded by the intermingling of the conscious self with the insentient body. This delusion must end. The identification of consciousness with form. How will it end, he's asked. That which is born must end. The delusion is only concomitant with the ego. It rises up and it sinks. But the reality neither rises nor sinks. It remains eternal. The master who has realized says so. The disciple hears, thinks over the words and realizes the self. The ever-present self needs no efforts to be realized because realization is always there. Illusion alone must be removed. Okay, I think that's enough on that. Okay, another question. This is on June 17th, 1936. And again, there's someone who comes who has was in the state of mourning, and Ramana says, why mourn the dead? They're free from bondage. Mourning is the chain that is forged by the mind that binds itself to the dead. What if anyone's dead? What if anyone is ruined? You should be dead yourself. You should be ruined yourself. In that sense, there is no pain after one's death. What is meant by this sort of death? Annihilation of the ego, though the body remains alive. If the ego persists, the man is afraid of death. So when Ramana says be ruined, he means go through complete depersonalization so that the ego is annihilated. So a man mourns another's death. He need not do so if he predeceases them by waking up from the ego dream, which amounts to killing the ego. The experience of deep sleep clearly teaches that happiness consists in being without the body. The wise also confirm it, speaking of liberation after the body is given up. Thus the sage is awaiting the casting off of the body. Just as a laborer carrying a load on his head for the sake of wages bears the burden with no pleasure, carries it to the destination, and finally unburdens himself with relief and joy. So also the sage bears the body, awaiting the right and destined time to discard it. If now you are relieved of one half of the burden, he's talking about you're relieved of your wife who died, right? Should you not be thankful and be happy for it? Nevertheless, you cannot be so because of your physical outlook. Even men who ought to know better and who have known the teaching about liberation after death glorify liberation along with the body and call it some mysterious power of keeping the body eternally alive. There will be no pain if the physical outlook is given up and if the person exists as the self. Mourning, grief, is not the index of true love. In fact, it betrays love of the object, of the shape only, not of the consciousness. That is not love. True love is shown by the certainty that the object of love is the self and that it can never become non-existent. So, I think it was particularly poignant because I think he had been visiting Aurobindo, whose project was to keep the body alive perpetually, which Aurobindo discovered wasn't possible. So, I'll just read one more, I think, maybe. Let me see what this one is. Okay. June 20, 1936. Ramana is asked why the mind can't be turned inward in spite of repeated attempts. And he says, it is done by practice and dispassion. And that succeeds only gradually, all right? Very few people achieve it instantly, as Ramana did, but as he once explained, he had done his work in a previous life. So it is a gradual process which requires a lot of practice. But dispassion, detachment, is necessary or the practice is not authentic. The mind, having been so long like a cow accustomed to graze stealthily on others' estates, is not easily confined to her stall, However much her keeper tempts her with luscious grass and fine fodder, she refuses the first time. Then she'll take a little bit, but her innate tendency to stray away will assert itself, and she slips away. But on being repeatedly tempted by the owner, she will accustom herself to remaining in the stall. And finally, even if allowed to be let loose, she wouldn't even go away. Similarly with the mind, once it finds its inner happiness, it will not wander outward. Okay, and Ramana was reading a translation of the Tiruvachakam, a book by a South Indian sage, and came across the stanzas describing the intense feeling of bhakti as thrilling the whole frame, melting the flesh and bones. And he remarked, the author, Manika Vachagar, is one of those whose body finally resolved itself in a blazing light without leaving a corpse behind. You know, this is very famous among the Tibetan Buddhists, the rainbow body and all of that. I'm sure you've heard of it. But this happened to many Indian sages. And another devotee then asked, well, how could that be? And Ramana said, the gross body is only the concrete form of the subtle mind stuff. When the mind melts away and blazes forth as light, the body is consumed in that process. And then Ramana goes on and says, another sage, Nandanar, also is one whose body disappeared in blazing light. And then Major Chadwick, one of his disciples, pointed out that in the Bible, Elisha also disappeared in the same way. And he desired to know if the disappearance of Christ's body from the tomb was like that. And Ramana said, no, no, Christ's body was left as a corpse, which was at first entombed, whereas the others did not leave corpses behind. Anyway, he goes on and they talk about the physics of all of this, but I don't think that's so important. So I'll read one last one. Ramana's asked, what is Atma Sakshatkar, which means the realization of the Atma, the self? Ramana says, you are the Atma. And that sakshat, is that realization, is here and now also. Where is the place for kara? In other words, sakshat kara means an action that brings about realization. It's not an action because you're always realized. So it's not something that happens to you. You don't get suddenly enlightened. That's a myth. You realize that you've always been only the divine light. But there was never anything but that. And there's no one who realizes it. Okay, so the question shows that you think you are not the self, or you think that there are two selves, one to realize the other. That is absurd. That you identify yourself with the gross body lies at the root of this matter. Well, this question arises now. Did it arise in your sleep? Did you not exist then? Certainly you existed in sleep. What's the difference between these two states? That the question should arise now, but not in sleep. Now you think you are the body. You see things around you, and you want to see the self in a similar manner. Such is the force of habit. The senses are mere instruments of perception, but you are the seer. Remain as the seer only. What else is there to see? Such is the state in deep sleep. Therefore, this question does not arise then. And he goes on to explain that the world that you, your eyes or your senses perceive is only a reflection of the self. It's not different. There is only the self. You think it's a world full of objects, but it's actually simply the way that the light of God shines, and with all of its infinite information and permutation, produces the illusion of a world, but it's only a mirage. And do not be fooled by wanting to drink from a mirage, because you'll never find real water there. If you want to satisfy your thirst, find the water of life within. Okay, I won't bore you with more, but I hope that was useful and interesting, and will be motivating and hopefully inspiring to achieve that ultimate luminosity, so that none of us will have to bury you at the end, because no corpse will remain, and there will just be light. And then we don't need to create some cemetery or crematorium here. So let's all try to save each other from that problem of waste disposal and achieve the ultimate realization while alive. So at that moment, the luminosity, the fire of God consciousness incinerates the form spontaneously. Floor is open if anyone wants to comment or ask any questions about any of that. How many found this useful? Yeah. How many found it boring? Nobody raised their hand. That's good. If it's useful to you, I suggest you read the whole book, because it's filled with gems of knowledge that those who meditate will find essential at different stages of your practice.
Can you tell us the name of it again?
What's that?
Can you tell us the name of it again?
The book? It's called Talks. That's all. Talks with Sri Ramana Maharishi.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Shinya. I was really struck by this idea of being active in the meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've, at the moment in meditation, I try and bring myself back to the present moment, and sometimes that's a sensation in the body, an anxiety or something like that, or something that I'm telling myself is anxiety, but just bringing that and then going into or trying to enter into the silence.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when I get into the silence is usually where there's a cut and I fall asleep, or a fantasy starts or something happens, and then the process goes again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that, it's almost like there's a paradox, because there has to be there's such a use to being an egoic activity that keeps the consciousness awake, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And this...
But you see, this is still the ego. You see, once the ego's vasanas have all disappeared, then there will be no difference between activity and inactivity. But as long as there is still a sense of a doer, then that's what you should do, is focus on the self. Because otherwise, as you say, you'll fall asleep or get distracted. So the activity will keep you one-pointed and the attention focused until you reach such a deep state that you're in that blissful awareness of God consciousness and awe and that sublime presence, that then you would never want to sleep through it, and then you can be absorbed into the real and never come back.
Thank you.
So, thank you. It's a good question. Important, I think, point of practice.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Shunya. I also had the same question, but I was wondering if you could give, what's the distinction between the active mind going to liberation and then the ego-active mind? Like how?
Okay, because you're not active in terms of thinking. The ego's activity is usually creating thoughts, right? This is the activity of attention. The attention must remain one-pointed. And it's really the activity of making sure there's no distraction and no ego thinking going on, and bringing yourself constantly back into silence and presence, but without thinking, but constantly returning to the source of the I or in the source of its thoughts. And then eventually you will reach that place of such depth that egoic activity will no longer occur. Then effort ends, and that effortless, blissful presence becomes constant. Okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
I'm just wondering whether the focus should be, like when I focus in my inside, I try and focus on the, like, inside the pineal or somewhere in there, it's more of an effort. And when I focus on the heart, it's less of an effort.
Ramana would disagree with any of those practices because you're assuming you're a bodily being and you're focusing on an object. Mm. Part of your body is the object. The question is, who's doing the focusing? That's what you want to know. And then you realize you're not the body at all. You're not even here. You're a cosmic awareness that has nothing to do with that body whatsoever. So it's a thought. I'm going to think about this or that. You don't even have a pineal gland. None of that is real. All of that is just part of the illusion. You know, your consciousness will remain even when you have no body, when the body is dead. What are you going to focus on then, right? Mm-hmm. So, no, focus on the self that is formless and has no objective correlate in the body.
Okay, so like on awareness, but it's kind of expansive. It's harder to contain.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. The source of awareness. What you're aware of is expansive. If you're looking at the world or objects or thinking about fantasies or whatever, but the awareness has no size, has no dimension. It's not an object. It can't be grasped. That's the real problem. You cannot grasp the self, and the ego wants to grasp it. I want to possess the self like I possess this book. I have it. I got it. No, it's the I that wants to get it that has to dissolve. You have to be aware of that I and realize that's not your real self. So the I doesn't really meditate. The attention has to go to the source of the I that has no desires, no intentions, and is pure eternal presence.
Okay.
And stay in that.
Okay. And then another, it's kind of off topic, but because my kids seem to be wanting to have kids at this point.
Well, do you care? They're not your kids.
Oh, okay.
And you don't have kids, you were never born. You don't have a body. You have to let go of those attachments if you're serious about spirituality.
Okay.
Let them do what they want. It's their karma. You can't stop them, and it doesn't even matter. God will take care of them. You have to just be in God consciousness. Then you can offer help. You can't offer any help as an ego.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Be free of all those thoughts and all of those desires to try to control anything in the world. You can't do it anyway, and it just causes suffering. Be totally free of all such concerns and be interested only in realizing God.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shunya. For the guided meditation and reading Ramana, I feel like reading Ramana helped to see more into the guided meditation and my effort to follow and go into it. I think what stood out most was the story about the cow that Ramana told, and this habit of going off that offered that that goodness, that love, and you find, you know, the cow, cultivate, you talk about that, cultivating mm-hmm. the taste for silence, for love. Yeah, because when I follow you in the meditation, it takes a great deal of attention and active focus, like in a session, to just be aware of what's constantly arising, but focus on what's aware of what's arising. But then when you start talking about go into the peace, go into the serenity of the silence, I don't know, it was a different, it's a different kind of moment in practice. It does feel more like that cow that's staying in the, like this, I want to stay in the stable. But anyway, I also realized also when I kind of melt more into that, there is something that comes up and I was finding it difficult and I opened my eyes and I looked at the candle and I did that for a while and it helps for those just the constant kind of thoughts to not keep arising and something else to focus on. But anyway, it was just very, and then you read about it. And it so anyway, don't have a question there, but thank you. And
thank you.
Okay, all right.
I had a question that I've been thinking about, wondering about, which is related to what Mary said. Not so much on a specific pineal, but the pinpoint of light that is there in relation to, I think, what's been said here about this being illumination, which is different than self-realization. And my question is that illumination or opening of the third eye by focusing on the light within the space that some people call is where the pineal region would be, is that a gateway or is it different entirely from self-realization?
It's different. You have to get to the self that is aware of the light. The light itself is not aware. There's an awareness of the light that's at a deeper level. And then you discover that the light you think is in the pineal gland is actually being sent down from another dimension. It has nothing to do with this. And that awareness is actually the source of the light. And so then you realize the true illumination, which is that of the cosmic self, not of the individual that's a ray from that self, but the fullness of that infinitely powerful light that is the God self. And you don't want to settle for that little light in the brain, because that's not the real light, that's a reflection.
At one point, I have had that open, so I understand what you're saying. When it's truly open, that illumination is God realization, if you can keep it open.
Well, God realization is more than that. That might be a portal, but when we speak of God, we're speaking of infinite intelligence, infinite power. Just an unimaginable and inconceivable greatness of being that cannot even be described. And so that light is just, an initial lure to that greatness. And you shouldn't be distracted by it.
So it is like a gateway?
It can be, but people often will stay in the gate, thinking that's all there is, and I'm enlightened because I found this little, light shining in my head. And that has nothing to do with real enlightenment.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I hope that all your questions have been answered and that there are no obstacles to the realization of the transcendent self that can only be known in that state which is total presence free of thoughts and free of any identification with a body or with an individual person. And by remaining in that absolute presence, you will know deep peace, bliss, and a spontaneous and inherent wisdom about reality that will be a constant flow of divine eloquence, as Ramana has said, and that will bring complete freedom from karma and from suffering and from any illusion or a bondage to the wheel of the sense of birth and death. And this freedom, once gained, will never be lost. And you can abide in eternity rather than going through another cycle of time. So, may you use your wisdom and your determination to attain the highest goal that you find valuable in life. And if you find the goal of liberation to be that, then you know what must be done. And there has to be a complete shift of paradigm from the belief in the ego and the belief that you're a bodily being and that you have children or parents or any relation to the illusory world. You belong only to God, and God is all that there is. Once that is realized, then you will know what freedom really is. Blessings for that supreme attainment. Namaste.